It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, the biggest issue in local government over the last year has been the labor ordinance, the discussion over whether to change the way our local government relates to municipal workers and the unions who represent them. A proposal came forward earlier in the year, went through a really tough fight at the assembly, was passed, and then was challenged with a referendum. A referendum went into court. There was another vote on it at the assembly. It's been quite a saga, but there hasn't always been a really clear discussion among all the principals involved. And what we're fortunate to be able to do today is bring in the key people on this subject and just sit down and have a roundtable discussion on what are the main principles, what are the main issues at issue here, and take your questions and find out what you'd like to know about our municipal labor ordinance. I have four guests in the studio. Mayor Dan Sullivan, thanks for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
Assemblymember Elvie Gray Jackson.
An honor to be here.
Gerard Esselin, who is the chairman of the Coalition of Municipal Unions. Is that the correct name for it?
Yes, sir. Yeah, thank you for having me.
And also a sergeant with APD.
Yes, sir.
And Ernie Hall, who's the chairman of the Anchorage Assembly.
Thank you. I appreciated the invitation.
I appreciate all of you being here, and I'm looking forward to a good discussion. And just to get listeners up to speed, the municipality has laws, ordinances, which control how negotiations take place between the municipal labor unions and the municipality. The mayor and Chairman Hall brought forward an ordinance to change that, which is known as AO 37. It has some provisions limiting the amount of annual pay raises, standardizes health benefits for employees, removes performance incentive programs in future contracts. Management is given control over staffing and scheduling. Use of seniority for some staffing decisions is part of at least one union contract now. New contracts are limited to 3 years. Several in the past have been for 5 years. Arbitrators are called in to resolve disputes and must pick one side or the other in total. They can't combine provisions from each side. It would take under the ordinance 8 of the 11 votes on the assembly to approve an arbitrator's decision. And if the assembly doesn't approve a decision, the municipality can implement its last best offer. Unions are prohibited from striking, and there's no binding arbitration in cases where employees were already prohibited from striking, such as police officers. And contracts must now allow for managed competition or outsourcing some city functions. So those are some of the major provisions from the ordinance. It went through a very contentious public hearing process. Enormous numbers of employees came out. That public hearing was closed before everyone had spoken. Some said it was a public filibuster. Some said it was just public testimony. The assembly voted 6-5 and passed the ordinance. There was then a petition drive. I guess 22,000 people signed a petition to put this on the ballot. That petition was challenged. It was not challenged. It was rejected by the municipal clerk, and it went into court, and I believe it's now in front of the Supreme Court to decide if that was a legal petition. In the meantime, there was the ordinance came back to the assembly. There was another vote on it. This time it was repealed by, I believe, a 7-4 vote, but Mayor Sullivan was able to veto that appeal. And now the issues that are out in front of the city are, will this go to the ballot? When will it go to the ballot? And will this ordinance become law? So I think I've covered sort of the general outline of it, and mostly as a newspaper reader. And I have to disclose, I am a former member of the assembly and generally friendly to labor unions. And if anybody feels I'm not being fair or disinterested, please call me on it today, because my job is to just be a fair moderator of the discussion. So just to start out, I want to go around our panel. We've got a dream team panel in the studio, and just get some sense of why you hold the position you do. Mayor Sullivan, what was your main reason for wanting to change the ordinance and bring in these new provisions?
Sure. A couple of things. First, as we examined the existing law dealing with how labor contracts are negotiated, had not been updated since 1988. So 25 years is a long time not to review a very important ordinance. And in that review process, we, in talking with our our staff and our directors, you know, for 4 years we've been hearing from them about how complicated these contracts have become, how much management rights had been given away over the course of the contracts, and how non-standardized and non-clear they are in many, many areas. And so our goal was really to simplify, clarify, try and make these contracts more consistent so they're easier to manage and easier to understand by both the people that have to be the managers and the employees who are working under the contracts. And so that's what the genesis of AO37 was about, was creating some standardization, some simplification, and really just trying to make it an easier process all the way around. When you have 9 different contracts to negotiate, I can tell you it's very, very difficult to do that without changing the law and trying to do it contract by contract by contract. And so that was how it all got started.
Right. Gerard Aslan, you represent the Coalition of Municipal Unions. What were the main reasons you opposed the ordinance?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, our concern came about when the lack of process from the beginning, the way that it really came about, literally the Friday afternoon type, without any sort of discussion or feedback on the development of the ordinance and the substantial changes that did come forth as a result of what was proposed. You know, when you have a situation where you are creating or changing a law that, yes, it's been 25 years since it's been reviewed, but been in existence for more than 40 years, it would be something that I think would be a more of a collective or cooperative process from the stakeholders, not something that's developed in private and literally sprung on the people that it affects, not just the employees, but the community as a whole, and then very much rushed through the process. So we've never said that we're against change. We're always open to change. We, as a collective group, have always had a willingness to sit down on the table and negotiate, as we have been for years and years. The history of since this law, and even since this administration's been in place, we've sat down at the table, and really that became impossible. We're in essence negotiating a law in public rather than a sit down collective discussion. So we had some frustrations about that, and certainly did oppose the sweeping changes.
Mm-hmm. So, Chairman Hall, you were a co-sponsor of this ordinance, and you've heard these concerns about process. Respond to the process issue, since that's been such a key one, and then maybe if you want to add anything to what the mayor said about why you support the ordinance.
Sure. Well, the process, the majority of all ordinances that get introduced to the body are introduced exactly that way. They're drafted and they're introduced because of serial meetings. We're not allowed to discuss that amongst ourselves anyway. So we're limited in our ability to have that conversation with each other. So the majority of all of the business that comes from the body is handled in that way, in that an ordinance gets drafted, it's introduced, and then we begin the process. And in this one, over the period of time, we address this over 7 weeks. There were 5 work sessions. We gave 2 work sessions to the employees for them to come in and give their discussion, their views, insights on to what was going on with it. So, the conversation, I think when the term rushed, maybe is a bit of an overstatement, that amount of time involved in addressing an ordinance. There's a lot of time for input from individuals. When I was running for and elected to the assembly, the interesting thing is, with all of us sitting here, we all have a job to do. And I have tremendous respect for Gerard. His job is to look out for the employees that he represents with the municipality. I see my job there as looking out to make sure that we take care of our employees, that they've got the benefits, they're well compensated, they've got the equipment that they need to do the job. But at the same token, I have a very strong responsibility to the community that elected me to make sure that I do the very best that I can for them in regards to what they pay in a tax bill every year. Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into everything that we do, whether it's a resolution or an ordinance. But the traditional process, and you are a member of the assembly, is ordinance get introduced, you had very little to do with it unless you drafted it yourself, and then the body gets a chance to work on it.
Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of different topics to come back to, and we will. But I want to make sure all four of our panelists get something of an opening statement. Mm-hmm. L.V. Gray Jackson, you're a member of the Assembly. You've opposed the ordinance from the beginning. Mm-hmm. What are your reasons for opposing it? And we've already got into this process issue. What are the key things there?
Okay, I think the mayor is absolutely right in terms of how long it's been since the ordinance had been revisited. I was staff to the Assembly, I think it was in 1989 or something, when there were changes made to the ordinance, and I remember the process back then. From the beginning, all the stakeholders were brought to the table before the ordinance was even introduced, and they had work sessions and meetings to get it right before it was brought for introduction, and it saved a whole lot of time. But the way this ordinance was handled was not handled in the same manner that that was. It could have been handled vastly different than it was. All the stakeholders needed to be brought to the table, and I'm sure the unions would have been willing to work things out. We needed to even involve the public at that level before it was even introduced, and I really believe that we would not be where we're at today if the process had been the same as it was in 89.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mayor Sullivan, one of the issues that we have gotten quickly into process as opposed to substance, but one of the things the ordinance addresses is right to strike, arbitration, limitations on the wages that can be brought in any 1 year. Were these things that you considered to be problems? Because we hadn't had a lot of strikes in our history.
Sure. Well, let me just respond really quickly to the process question, and I agree with Mr. Hall. A drafting of an ordinance is internal work product. You work with your attorney, you work with your CFO, you work with your employee relations director, you listen to 4 years worth of directors telling you the many challenges they have in implementing these contracts. So the internal work product becomes public when you lay it on the table. 5 work sessions is the most I've ever been involved with in my 14 years of public service. 20 hours of public testimony matches as much public testimony as I've ever seen, plus hundreds and hundreds of emails and calls and faxes. This had more public process than just about any ordinance I've ever seen involved at the local level. So I think the process thing's a bit of a red herring. This had a tremendous amount of public input. And again, as the chairman said, 2 work sessions just alone with the union leadership to make sure we got their comments and their feedback before the bill went forward. You know, in the legislature, they have committees, and each committee gets a chance to put their imprint on a bill. We do it through work sessions, and again, with 5 work sessions and 20 hours of testimony, we had a tremendous public mm-hmm. process. As far as the particulars of the bill itself, and this is what I really like to talk about, because I've yet to have anybody really adequately counter that these things just aren't common sense. 3-year contracts, for example, that's what the state has by law, and there's a reason for it. If the economy changes, you want that flexibility to get back and negotiate at the end of a contract a new one that might reflect the economic times that you're in. Raise is limited to the CPI plus 1%. That's your local economy. What would you negotiate a contract on, somebody else's economy? Of course not. It has to reflect your local economy. The CPI plus 1% does that. CPI, of course, is the consumer price index. That's the rising prices of goods and services. And the 1% takes into account a growing population and new construction. So we left it where we felt there was enough flexibility within those numbers to make sure, and that's a ceiling, that's the limit, but that you were matching what the local economy dictates. It makes perfect common sense to me. Some of the other provisions, the right to strike, for example, the Supreme Court has already ruled that public employees do not have the right to strike. You can negotiate it away, but why would you? Because why should the public, who's paying for public services, ever be denied those services because management and labor are not in agreement on a contract? You know, they have nowhere else to go for some of these services. There's absolutely no reason they should suffer while we're in negotiations. And so the right to strike, and that's why the Supreme Court ruled the way they did, public should never be denied those services.
Mm. Now, you've just, as I understand from this morning's paper, have completed a contract with the AMEA, the Anchorage Municipal Employees Association, which is one of our major unions. And that was done under the old ordinance because the new ordinance is kind of in abeyance during the court action, as I understand it.
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, we negotiate as if AO 37 is still in effect. I mean, that's just our negotiating posture from day one. We don't need the ordinance under this administration. I put forth this ordinance for future administrations so that you couldn't get a situation like we had with the baggage administration, where a mayor and a complicit assembly and a complicit bunch of union groups basically, in the midst of the worst recession in 70 years, passed the richest contracts in Anchorage history, putting tremendous pressure on the fiscal health of the city. AO 37 was designed to prevent that in the future by setting very strict guidelines on what could be negotiated and how much you can negotiate, so we don't make that horrible business mistake again.
Okay, so that's an interesting point. So you don't feel it's necessary if the person in the mayor's office is sort of your perspective, you don't feel it's necessary, you can negotiate for what you need. You're trying to sort of bind future mayors to...
Right, because to undo the law would have to, again, be a very public, transparent process, and a mayor would have to basically publicly declare that, oh, I think these rules are too restrictive, and I want to give more of your hard-earned taxpayer dollars to the union groups, and again, then you have a public process involved. And again, do we need it for this administration? No, we've already negotiated several contracts. We've negotiated with the Laborers 71. They signed that deal. We did it under the auspices of AO 37, even though it's suspended. And same thing with AMEA. And we're going to take that exact same posture with every contract we negotiate.
All right. So, Mr. Esslin, you didn't really address the substance of the ordinance and your first response to it. Do you think these are important issues in terms of right to strike, arbitration, limits on raises, limitation on what you can negotiate on?
Yeah, I think as the mayor has characterized in the past, as he did here today, when you take each of those things individually, they sound quite reasonable. It sounds like something that is obtainable. But when you look at the collective change that occurred, that's where it becomes rather shocking. It wasn't just a little change here, a little change there. It was quite dramatic changes that would absolutely result in across-the-board reductions for working employees of the city. And I hear a lot of conversation about it being about the unions and the unions, and the reality is what we're talking about here is just working class people, and we serve, the unions can serve as kind of that barrier, and quite frankly, we've kind of heard it said before that the unions, if anything, have kind of earned their medal in this, because I'm really fear to think what would happen if the unions and these contracts didn't exist. And really the mayor himself has made his point today that we have said all along that the administration can come to the table with any sort of deal that they think is appropriate. And as long as it's well researched, it's plausible, it's legally defensible, we as the negotiating groups recognize that, and we know we can't push back on it, right? If this is a fair wage, if this is the fair contract term, if this is fair health benefits, then all those are there, and that's what we all kind of end up with. But by binding not only as this administration, but all future administrations to an extremely restrictive law, now we're not talking about bargaining policy, we're talking about a law, we tie everybody's hands to something that's overly constrictive.
Well, from the taxpayer's point of view, I'm responding to the mayor's point that, you know, the employee unions are involved in politics. If they get a sort of a friendly mayor in office, you know, can they then cut their own deal? So there needs to be some kind of a sideboard to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, it's an interesting comment that you say that, you know, and what we saw in the passage of AO 37 was a mayor of a particular connection with a complicit assembly, and that's what allowed AO 37 to be passed without the process ahead of time, and it was rushed. I'd like to be able to say that the description of the hours and the work sessions is really relevant, but the reality is we all knew from day one we were on a timeline to get it passed prior to the next election. We shouldn't be making law based on election cycles. Law should be based
on the
foundation.
In other words, they get it passed before those assembly members who were on the assembly at that time might be gone, and then you might not have the mayor might not have the 6 votes to get it passed. You feel that was a rush?
Yeah, exactly.
But what about this point that's been made that the employees were holding essentially a filibuster? They were just going to keep talking it to death. And is that really fair?
No, to suggest that citizens coming before their representative government is some form of filibusters, I think is rather preposterous, actually. It degrades the system as the way that it's designed. People should have an opportunity to come and address their government, and that's a responsibility of a democratic society, right? We should all be able to have have that discussion and have that input. And you say, well, they're employees. Well, because they're employees, does that mean they shouldn't have a voice and they shouldn't be able to come forward and say, here's what I think about this particular piece of legislation? You know, this particular direction and the is really came against the employee groups. But I would challenge anybody, and we're seeing it with other things. What if it's, let's use the tennis for an example. At what point is it okay for them to say, we don't want to hear from these mm-hmm. citizens because they're only here about tennis. They're only here about their right or their interest, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what this assembly yeah. tried to say. We've heard what you have to say. Those more than 100 or so people that are waiting, we've already heard what you have to say. You don't have anything yeah. new. They're citizens. They have rights to talk to their well, government.
And we've got Chairman Hall here. So let's. I'd like to hear, did you... Give us your thought process in deciding to close that hearing. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of feedback and disagreement with that. Did you feel it was a filibuster, and do you regret making that decision?
Well, number one, I didn't make the decision, Charles. You were on the assembly. It takes 6 votes to make a decision.
But the chair sort of issues a ruling, and then the assembly can agree.
This was a motion made by another assembly member in 6 votes.
You voted for it?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, well, then make that decision.
Yes, I did. I voted mm-hmm. for it. When we got ready to do the public hearings on this, we knew it was going to take an extended period of time. So I sat down and I had a conversation with labor leaders, Gerard, Derek, a number of others, and said, give me an idea about how long you think that you need for us to be able to handle this. And at that time, they figured maybe 3 days. First night, there's going to be a large body of people. We're going to do, you know, a demonstration, all the logic in the world. So I was with that. Second night, it'll not be as many. And by the third night, we will pretty well be worked out. So at the second night, I went back to check and how many do we have left. And at that time, I was told around 120 people. So we're halfway through the second evening, probably not a problem with 3 days. And in the middle of the third night, I went back and said, how many are we down to? And at that point, it was about 280. So I asked...
So in other words, it was going up.
The number was going up. Like I say, there were a lot of emails going around at that time. We need people to testify. So at that point, I asked to get me a list of names of people that are here to testify. And after about 20 minutes, they come back and said, no, we can't get a list of names. So, you know, my thought at that point was, you get them to sign up, we'll let everyone that's on the list testify. But I was told, no, we can't get a list. I said, well, they're here to testify. Yeah, but they're coming and going. So I said, okay, fine. And to be honest with you, you know, I'd gone to direction to pass chairs. I've gone to legal. There's nothing in municipal code. Charter says reasonable time. The legal advice I got was, well, at some point, if it's the vote of the body to end testimony, then you can end it that way. So, the evening of the third day, there was a motion made to extend to do another full day of testimony. And at that point, it was actually for 3. It was extended to a full 5 hours. And so at the end of the 5 hours, there had been a motion made the previous night and voted on that we would close public testimony. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that was essentially the process that we went through.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the Municipal Labor Ordinance, the famous AO37, and we've got an all-star panel in the studio, with all bases covered. You were just hearing from Ernie Hall, who's the chairman of the Anchorage Assembly. Mayor Dan Sullivan is with us, as well as Gerard Astlin, who's president of the Coalition of Municipal Unions, and Assembly Member L.V. Gray Jackson. And this point was raised, and I think we could talk about the closing of the public testimony for quite a while. I don't want to spend the whole hour on that. But this point was raised about the assemblies and mayors being too generous, and that you need to pass a law that will prevent that from happening. And I'm just wondering if you care to respond to that, Ms. Gray Jackson, about your do you think that's a legitimate way to use the labor ordinance to prevent future mayors and assemblies from being too generous?
I'm kind of having a hard time answering your question because I'm not really clear on what it is you're asking
well,
me.
Well, the mayor made the point that he says he doesn't need AO 37 in order to negotiate contracts during this term, but he wants to prevent future mayors from, you know, giving away the store, as it were. And so by limiting the negotiating rules in through AO 37, can keep that from happening.
Well, first of all, with all due respect to the mayor, I think that since the ordinance is not in effect, that how can you negotiate on an ordinance that's really not in effect? So I think there's an issue there. In terms of him thinking that, well, this is a good idea for future mayors to have an ordinance in place for future negotiations with future mayors, well, if it had been done in the right place, I could buy that. In the right way, I'm sorry, I could buy that argument, but it really wasn't. You know, the way, and we've all expressed it, the way, well, a couple of us anyway, the way this ordinance came about was behind closed doors. The stakeholders weren't brought to the table from the beginning. It was pushed through. And the only reason why I believe we had so much public testimony is because our employees were upset and they wanted to be heard because they were not involved from the beginning.
Do you feel that municipal pay and benefits are have gone up too much in the last 5 years, that baggage contract was excessive? Or do you think that you know, that our municipal employees are compensated reasonably and the process has worked up to now?
I think our municipal employees are compensated reasonably. And one of the things that people forget is that they deserve respect, just like everybody else. These are the folks, the men and women in our community who provide the services for our constituents. They also pay taxes. They also have children that go to our schools. They also contribute to our economy.
All right. I want to give you a chance to answer that question, Chairman Hall, because we really didn't get in. We stuck with process with you. I didn't give you a chance to get into that sort of core issue.
Yeah.
Are the employees paid too much?
You know, when I was first running for office, you know, I was asked that a lot by labor. And I told them I support any contract that's been out and fairly negotiated. And the contracts they were operating under had been fairly negotiated. Whatever the outcome was, you know, we have two sides. And I have no problem with that, just like I have no problem with the way that we handle bargaining. I think it's a fair measure. You know, one of the reasons that I was a co-sponsor of AO 37 was, quite honestly, when I first read it, I was shocked that any mayor would actually propose a code that would limit his authority. I saw the long-range advantage of that. And the thing that particularly struck me at that time is I see what's going on across the country. We've got Detroit that's in bankruptcy because they made commitments they couldn't keep. They hired employees. They made commitments for pension funds that they don't have the funding to be able to do it. Philadelphia has just laid off 5,000 teachers because they can't pay their teachers and pay the commitments they've made to retirees. I feel they've got an obligation to meet that. That was an honest, binding contract. But somebody wasn't looking far enough ahead to understand that you don't make commitments that you can't meet. And when I saw that, you know, we're looking at the possibility here of restricting to the CPI plus one, I think everything that's negotiated out there are negotiated under those terms to give a mayor, any mayor, the authority to go, we don't care what the CPI is, you go and just negotiate it. I was surprised to see the fact that a mayor would actually say, this is something that should be put in code. We need a way to ensure that in the future we don't commit ourselves to obligations that we can't meet.
Yeah, and I guess, and this is maybe one you want to respond to later, but I don't get the mayor's opinion on it. In any contract that is negotiated is obviously directed by the mayor, and the assembly has to approve it. Isn't that the democratic process? You know, if the public elects an assembly or mayor who feel that it's important to give raises in 2% above CPI or to negotiate some of these other items, why shouldn't they be able to?
Well, I think, as Mr. Hall said, you have to have a bit more of a long-term view. In 2008, and Ms. Gray Jackson was on the assembly, voted for the contracts in 2008. We voted for the richest contracts in Anchorage history in the midst of the worst recession in 70 years. You have declining revenues, and in that situation, you dramatically increase your expenses. That is a horrible business decision, and you just don't want future mayors and assemblies to make horrible business decisions. So you put rules in place to prevent it. It's no different than, you know, some of the regulations we put on various business or banking activities to prevent those kind of bad business decisions. And it just really, you know, we've been fighting against it now for the last 4.5 years, constant upward pressure because of the employee contracts. And don't get me wrong, I love my employees. They do a great job. But I've got 298,000 other people out there that basically rely on myself and the assembly to make good business decisions. And that's really all this does, is to make sure that in the future, we don't have what happened in 2008, and that was a horrible business decision. But let me add one more thing to that. The leading up to 2008, you had Mayor Begich and his administration enter into over 130 illegal actions. They changed contracts, they changed the terms of contracts, and did not take them to the assembly as required by law. Over 131 violations, or 34 violations of municipal law. And then those got rolled into the 2008 contracts, and when they're voted on, all of a sudden became legal. You know, that is the basis of my frustration. And the unions, bless their hearts, did any of them ever come to the assembly or to the municipal attorney and go, hey, wait, these changes need to come to the assembly for approval? I mean, these were illegal acts, hundreds of them, and unacceptable. And that's why these regulatory sideboards, as you put it, are necessary.
All right. We've got a lively discussion today on Hometown Alaska. The panelists are Mayor Dan Sullivan, who you just heard from, Assemblyperson Elvy Gray Jackson, Gerard Asplund, President of the Coalition on Municipal Unions, and Ernie Hall, the Chairman of the Anchorage Assembly. We're going to be back in a minute. We're going to take a break. I'm going to give out right now the phone numbers so that you can get on the air with your questions for our panel. The phone number here in the Anchorage Bowl is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and I will read those emails on the air to the extent that we have time. So we're going to be back in 1 minute with more of Hometown Alaska. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about AO37, the Municipal Labor Ordinance, today. And in the studio, we have sort of all the key people involved. Mayor Dan Sullivan, Assembly Chair Ernie Hall, Assembly Member Elvy Gray Jackson, and Gerard Asplund, President of the Coalition on Municipal Unions. And your questions and comments are welcome as well in this last half hour. I wanted to save the first half hour to kind of let everybody state their case. But I know members of the public have concerns and questions on this topic, and so we welcome you to call. The number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So the current situation, as I understand it, is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Mayor, the Assembly brought up a repeal of the ordinance and did repeal it. Two assembly members changed their minds, but then you were able to veto the repeal, so the ordinance remained on the books.
That's correct.
But the ordinance is currently in stasis because it's this referendum is before the court.
Referendum got enough signatures, the court is suspended. And just in response to Ms. Mm-hmm. Gray Jackson, when I say we're negotiating under the auspices of it, we can take any negotiating position we want. We don't need the law in effect. We basically set parameters in our negotiations. These are the things that we're going to strive for. The union comes back and says these are the things we're going to strive for. So it doesn't matter whether the law is in effect or not. Each administration can basically set their own parameters on what they're going to negotiate on, how much and what.
Well, let me get your reaction to the assembly members changing their mind, and now you've apparently only got four members who support your position. Does that mean that the tide has turned in terms of public opinion and that you're in the minority now, or do you have what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think, you've got some members who are up for election, and I think maybe they're being a little bit tentative about what approach to take on a controversial issue. It's always been my opinion that, if you stick with your principles, you always do much better with the voters. You know, I got elected three times to the Assembly, and in the Turnagain area, of course, is a very liberal area, and I always carried that area because I think they respected the fact that I stuck to my guns and always went to the community councils and told them why I voted the way I did, and this is what I was thinking. And I think you may not always get somebody's vote, but sometimes you get their respect, mm-hmm. and that's just as important.
Why not let the referendum go to a vote? It seems like if this is such a hot issue, shouldn't the public vote on it?
Absolutely. It should go to a vote if the Supreme Court says that a referendum can be used for this sort of action. We take the contention, of course, that labor's things are administrative in nature, not subject to referendum. We expect to hear from the Supreme Court in February. But if it's going to go to a vote, I don't understand why the unions are afraid of it going to a vote where there's a big voter turnout. This is a very important issue. We want as many people weighing in on this as possible because it is a big issue for our community. A small turnout election can be dominated by a special interest group. We want an election where the general election in November has 70,000 more voters than a small election in April. Big issue. Let's get the most voters to decide as we can.
Right. But doesn't that protect some of your assembly members who are afraid of being on the ballot with a controversial issue? And obviously, last time it came up, it was brought out a lot of pro-union voters.
That's up to them to figure out, what affects their elections or not. My sole purpose is I want the whole community to weigh in on this. It's that important, and I don't see why everybody's afraid of having a big turnout election on a big issue.
Ms. Gray Jackson, would you like to see that come up to the vote as soon as possible?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. When you get 22,000 signatures, to me it's very, very clear that they want to be heard. They want to be heard as soon as possible. And it just simply doesn't make sense to me to postpone an election to 2015 when we have an election coming up in 5 months. And it's not going to cost anything.
Mm-hmm. Can I just jump in? Yeah. The election would actually be in 2014 in the November election, from what I'm understanding. So it would be this year. And the law is suspended already. So what difference does it make? It's already suspended.
And if I may, Charles, I believe that the ordinance said that we could have the election at the primary in August or at the 2015 election. But as I was stating, I just think it really doesn't make sense after 22,000 folks have signed a petition. They want to be heard. I mean, 36,000 people voted in the last election. Look at the numbers, 22,000 for one petition and 36 that actually came out to vote. I can't guarantee you, but I do believe when we have this election on April 1st, if we have it on April 1st, 2014, that there will be a phenomenal number of folks who come out to vote. Because let me also say this. Not only were people concerned about AO37 and the way it happened, basically getting pushed down the throats of this community, were union employees. There were many, many emails and testimony from folks who were no part of a union whatsoever, had no family members who were parts of a union. They were just really upset about the way things were done and how they were left out of the public process and that the transparency factor was not there.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Hall, you were up for election last April.
Yes.
And you looked like you were going unopposed, and then a young man jumped in and did a write-in campaign and ran a heck of a campaign and came pretty close considering those circumstances. Was that because of this ordinance being on the ballot? I mean, this ordinance being a hot topic.
Well, the turnout was definitely generated by the ordinance. But it was definitely turned out to a special interest. I had no candidate, so have you ever tried to raise funds when you're running unopposed? You know, and number one, when I'm running unopposed, I wouldn't ask people for money. I don't do treasure chests to be sitting there, and you're limited by laws to what you can have anyway. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to run a campaign, I would love to do a two-week write-in, where if I've got a substantial amount of money, and Labor threw a tremendous amount of money against me, and they did a tremendous amount of door knocking, mm-hmm. to get a turnout. And it's I think it refers to somewhat what the mayor was talking about, is what can happen if there's a small turnout. I mean, you know, Charles, it's embarrassing the people that turn out. I had the largest turnout in any district, and only 22% of the people in my district voted. In Eagle River, 15% voted. So that's a matter of where, when you get a small turnout.
So you feel it should be scheduled in the fall rather than the spring election. And I think you, LV Great Jackson, thank you for being with us. I know you have another appointment.
I'm so sorry. I can't stay any longer. I sure would like to, but I need to go. I got another appointment. But thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So do you feel, Chairman Hall, that the... that this vote should be in the fall, and I mean, does that kind of protect the assembly members who are up for election in the spring, so they don't have to be on the ballot when this hot issue is on the ballot?
I don't think, in regards to the election, this issue being on that ballot is going to make a difference. I think there's going to be a tremendous effort to probably get some people out of office, just like happened against me in my election. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what happens with that, and you know, I guess my term is Twitterpated myself into whether this should be on the April election or in the November election. I agree. I think it's very important. I think a large turnout would really better represent the community in how they vote on that. But I have a real issue with the amount of money that we have to spend in order to be able to do it, because it's still, even though it's with the state election, it's still a special election for us. So,
and now, as I understand it, because of some of these very complex things about the mayor's veto power and what's happened with the different ordinances that are passed to set it, that's going in front of the court too as to when the election will be held. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
Well, whether or not the mayor has the power to veto the assembly setting an election date.
Right.
All right.
I'd like to touch.
And frankly, I don't want to get too deeply into that because it's so confusing. But go ahead.
Right. No, I'd just like to touch on that. Ever since I've been on the assembly, there's been a continuous issue about what the mayor can or the mayor cannot veto. And when this particular item come up, I had conflicting interest, conflicting direction from the assembly attorney as well as from the city attorney. One yes, no, and the other. So I went down and I had a conversation with the mayor, and I said, you know, I think we should work together. This should be friendly, but it's time this question got answered. So that's why on that night, you know, I was sitting there. I knew that if the mayor vetoed and I recognized the veto or not. So I just literally stated that evening, I've got conflicting opinion, and I want this referred to the court for a decision. The mayor was in consensus with that. So it's going to be a big deal for the community, more than they may realize, because we're finally going to get a judicial decision on what the veto authority of a mayor is.
We have a question from a listener via email. Will the mayor be proposing an ordinance to limit pay increases for non-union administrators? In other words, you feel future mayors should be limited in how they can negotiate with the union members. Should they be limited in giving raises to the executives and the non-reps?
You know, that's interesting, because it's an apples and oranges comparison. The executive staff, for example, you know, works many, many times, 60, 70 hours a week. They don't get overtime. They don't get step increases. They don't get performance pay. They don't get longevity pay. So quite frankly, they're limited by not having all those enhancements into their pay system. So my executives, for example, over the course of 4.5 years, have received a 1% increase in 4.5 years, because when we first came into office, we had them all take a 5% pay cut. Well, over 4.5 years, they've gotten 6% back for a net of 1% increase. The unions over that period of time have gotten between 12 and 15% increase. So we've managed by leading by example with our executive staff and quite frankly, you know, what future administrations might do, again, with no overtime, no step increases, no pay enhancements, the executive staff is already limited in what they can get. Plus, each of the executives is within a range, and so there's an upper limit on what they can ever get.
Gerard Asland from the Union Coalition, do you have a thought on that? I mean, is there a need to limit executive and non-rep salaries?
It seems that really our desire would be that all positions be adequately and fairly compensated, whether that be executive, rep, non-rep, doesn't matter to us. The idea is that really people should be compensated based upon the market, based upon what's fair for that position. And, you know, it's admirable if the mayor says that they took pay cuts and things of that nature. But ultimately, I suppose you have to be able to show that what you're willing to pay the person in total pay and benefits is enough to be able to attract qualified people for those positions. And I would suggest, particularly in my field, that that's not the case right now. We haven't been able to attract the desired number of people, in part due to pay and benefits. So if the mayor's been able to keep his staff up based on the pay and benefits he's able to offer, then great. I'm glad.
So what about this issue that's been raised by Chairman Hall and the mayor about let's not get in a situation like Detroit, you know, that we need to, prevent excessive salaries from being negotiated because, you know, the city could get into some kind of financial trouble in the future. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I guess there's a whole host of things I could certainly say both opinion and fact about that. But in part, we talk about the long-term contracts. Not all unions had long-term contracts. There's also always an option if we have come to the table, I can speak to my union in particular, we've come to the table when there's been concerns expressed. If the mayor will recall, several years ago, he threatened the layoff of 30-some police officers. I think it was 30 was the number. And we voluntarily came to the table and had very serious discussions with the mayor about that because he's kind of painted this gloom and doom scenario, the sky is falling and then, oh my gosh, and then it's not. And when that happened, when the mayor said, we have true budget problems, I'm looking at eliminating 30 police officer positions, we came to the table, we sat down, we had honest, sincere discussions, and then at the last second was immediately turned down. We had offered to give up money to make up that difference. And now in hindsight, it becomes blatantly clear because he had a long-term plan of introducing the AO37. But my point in that is that we have always been willing to come to the table. We took contract concessions right out of the chute. We've offered them since then. Anytime there's a meet and confer in a proper fashion, we come to the table, we talk. That's what we're here for. It's a collective, collaborative process. And unfortunately, this administration hasn't really availed themselves of those options.
Well, what are you losing in particular that would prevent you from being able to negotiate in that fashion in the future? You were unable to strike as police officers.
That's right. Yeah, we in particular had binding arbitration, which is, I think, a very important component, particularly for public safety type aspects where you've got to have police, you've got to have fire, you got to have people there. There's got to be the ability to create honest feedback and give and take on both sides. And when you have what's proposed in AO 37, it eliminates collective bargaining, and it's this roughly coined as a baseball arbitration. But ultimately, in all scenarios, it would come back to the mayor's last best offer, if not approved by a supermajority of the assembly. And as evidenced by some of the recent wrangling, supermajority is pretty tough to come by. And we don't really think that's fair bargaining. You know, we want good faith, collective discussion. And when you know that you basically hold all the cards and I can hold to what I think is fair, as the mayor and his staff, I can hold to that position and I don't have to deviate from it because ultimately, after all the steps, it comes back to what I wanted anyway. That's really not good faith.
Mayor, can you respond to that? Why?
Sure. Yeah. Well, number one, as I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has already ruled that public employees do not have the right to strike. And if all the other unions have just regular arbitration, why should police and fire have binding arbitration? If we take the premise that no municipal employee has the right to strike, because I mentioned before, the public should never have to suffer a lack of service while management and labor are in negotiation. So if we take the premise that nobody has the right to strike, then why should they have binding arbitration but all the other unions not have binding arbitration? Binding arbitration is often decided by somebody from outside of the state who has no interest in this community and is not accountable to the community. The assembly is accountable. If they approve contracts or disapprove contracts that the public doesn't like, they have recourse. They can go to the polls. And George, one comment about it eliminates collective bargaining. No, it doesn't eliminate collective bargaining. It puts another term into the collective bargaining process. And again, as we look at the substance of AO 37, as you said before, point by point by point, it all makes common sense. Well, then collectively, how could it not make common sense if each individual point makes common sense? So, again, I think they keep harkening back to the process. And again, as we explained, the process was as extensive and as open as and as involved by the public as anything I've ever been involved with in my 14 years of public service. So,
other employers in town have to negotiate under rules that are set by the federal government, you know, the National Labor Relations Board, and their employees can strike. And yet the municipality, you get to make the rules and you can say you can't strike and you get to take things off the table before you start. So why is that fair?
Well,
just responding to his
point. Sure. The municipality can't pack up and move its business. You know, you can get a company like a Boeing, for example, and if they don't like the labor conditions in their state, they can move to South Carolina or somewhere else. Municipality can't do that. We have to stay where we are. We have to provide that service. So there's a huge difference between the public sector and the private sector and what rules you're working under when it comes to strikes and arbitration.
All right. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We've got about 10 minutes left. A surprising lack of calls today. I thought we'd be flooded with calls, but I guess you guys are, your silver tongues have intimidated anyone. But if anyone does want to get on with this in the last few minutes here, the phone number is 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And email is hometownalaskapublic.org. My guests today are Mayor Dan Sullivan, or Ernie Hall, the chairman of the Anchorage Assembly, Gerard Aslan, who's president of the Coalition of Municipal Unions. And Gerard, I think you had a point you wanted to make in response to the mayor.
Yeah, I just wanted to have a comment in regards to, you know, the reason for this. As the mayor said, this isn't necessarily for his and his administration, but for all future administrations. It's presumptuous to assume that what this particular individual and team of individuals thinks is best is going to be best for today and today forward. The way the collective bargaining law is designed, it allows for a framework. It allows for some latitude and some movement within that. The way AO 37 is structured is so completely restrictive that it does take a lot of things off the table. And so it's interesting, you know, you can take the single line items and individually, like I said, they might sound reasonable.
They are reasonable.
What we're talking is across the board reduction and removal of certain rights and certain availability of options. And let's just talk about wages. You know, let's say we're faced with a situation where we need to have a market-based adjustment. You know, we've got, I'll use a road grader, for example. We get the pipeline going in and now private industry wants to hire road grader operators and they're offering double the salary because they really need them up, you know, to lay the foundation for a pipeline. What are we now as a municipality going to do when the law prohibits, makes it illegal to give any sort of pay raises in excess of CPI plus one? You know, that's just an example I would use where you create overly restrictive language that prohibits the ability for this employer, the municipality, to be responsive to the market conditions. You know, and we'd ask about what does free market do? Free market should be that you should be able to respond to what's needed as a by an employer.
Mm-hmm. It looks to me like Chairman Hall has something he wants to respond to.
Well, I think it's important that we all recognize that we have a tax cap in this community, and that tax cap is the CPI and the 1% that can go with growth. So, you know, any good business is going to tell you that no matter what the market might be, you're not going to be able to pay any more than you've got in revenue. So,
but I mean, it is true during the pipeline years, isn't it? And I think Mayor Sullivan's father may have actually been mayor when there was a severe labor shortage and there was a huge inflation in wages and big increases were given, big increases in benefits just because they couldn't keep people on the job. How would you deal with that under AO 37?
And the mayor would have to answer this. My memory doesn't go back that far. I don't know if the tax cap was in place at that time.
Yeah, it was not.
It was not. No, it came in the early 80s after my dad had already left office. And, you know, the answer to that is just simply what Mr. Hall said. We do have a limit on what the public is willing to pay, and that is the tax cap. And to say that you could somehow meet market wages and exceed the tax cap, well, by law, you can't do that. So, but the tax cap grows generously enough every year where I think we'd be able to still find good qualified workers. And, you know, in some cases, what it means is you hire younger folks and train them, and you bring in the new entry-level positions. I mean, at some point, you have to have that transition in the workforce anyway. In fact, one of the challenges we're having right now is we need to do a better job in our succession planning for, you know, like folks in the water utility that are skilled technicians and other skills. And so that's a problem that we're encountering now. We're facing it, and we're starting to take some actions to deal with it. But that's one of the strategies you would use. You'd bring in new, younger, less expensive workers and let them grow into the positions and grow in their pay.
I'm interested in in the last 5 minutes or so we have we've had this very contentious debate in this town, and it sort of drowned out a lot of other things we could be talking about, and it surely has had some impact on the morale of employees, and certainly has had political impact too. I guess turning to you, Chairman Hall, as one of the sponsors, do you have any regret of bringing this forward? Was it worth all of this? And, you know, especially since if it comes to a vote, you know, it's very possible it could be repealed by the voters. The Assembly has already voted to repeal it. Was this a good one to bring forward? Were there mistakes made in how it was brought forward?
If there was anything that I could do to change this, this wouldn't have been introduced on the day that it was introduced on. Other than that, no, there's not. You know, Charles, we've got some tough times coming at us. We're dealing with Senate Bill 21. We don't know if that's going to repeal or it's not going to repeal. What we do know,
which is the reduction in oil taxes.
With the reduction in oil taxes. What we do know is we're below 500,000 barrels a day in a pipeline. It's continuing to drop at 7% a year. It is our resource in the state of Alaska. We've been blessed with the fact that the price of oil has gone sky high, and we haven't really realized that drop. We're seeing the East Coast begin to get flooded with oil. So we don't know what's going to happen within that. But one thing that's really important for me to say prior to us closing with this is I started out with making the statement that we've all got our jobs to do. The mayor, myself, we're elected by the community to represent the community to try to make as small a burden on them as we can so that they can have a great life. Gerard is charged with taking care of the employees, but I want you to know we've got the finest employees any place in the nation in this city. I couldn't be more proud of working with them, and we are a team. And it's difficult to the fact that we come to the point where we do have to negotiate these type of issues, but it's just part of our jobs, and we both, we all go out and try to do the very best that we can. But I want to make sure that, I try to hold the cost as much as I can. And what we did in AO35, nobody took a pay cut. There is no pay cuts in there. Mm-hmm. What I saw us doing was resetting the bar somewhat to what the mayor said, where new guys coming in at a lower rate, but the guys that are there are going to continue until they go pass through the system and get into their retirement.
And now, since we're running out of time, I want to give each of you a chance, probably a minute or less. Has this affected the workforce, Gerard Aslan? Has it had negative effects on the people out there doing the job? And, your response to that?
Yeah, absolutely it has. I think that as any sort of working person or you look to your management as an example of what a leader would do, basically leadership, right? And you want to have faith that the decisions they make are in the best interest of the whole without being influenced by external things. It's kind of we want to have faith that we're going to be treated fairly. As Chairman Hall said, you know, we do have a very good workforce here, one people that are dedicated in the job they do and the services they provide to this community. They come here every day and do the job, and I wish there was some acknowledgement of that without, frankly, the lack of respect that's being shown thus far. And you know, financially, we need to look at it. But like we've said, we can come and talk.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Sullivan, you'll get the last word.
Yeah, thanks.
And it looks a little bit like your ordinance is at risk with the assembly kind of changing its vote and a referendum out there. Was this the right move to make? And are you glad you did it?
Well, absolutely. Because as Chairman Hall said, again, you have to look long term. You know, after the 2008 contracts, for the next subsequent years, I heard from so many people in the private sector that weren't getting raises. And in the meantime, they're seeing public employees getting guaranteed raises year after year, plus all the hidden raises with the hidden benefits in the contracts. And they're going, I'm paying for these exorbitant raises, and I haven't gotten a raise in 3 years. How do you justify that to the public that has to pay for these contracts? So, and as Chairman said...
And I'm sorry, we're out of time. I hate to cut you off. You hear the music there. Hey, it's been a very interesting hour for me. I really want to thank Mayor Dan Sullivan for coming in, L.V. Gray Jackson, who was here earlier, a member of the Anchorage Assembly, Ernie Hall, the chair of the Assembly, and Gerard Asplund, president of the Coalition on Municipal Unions. Next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Kathleen McCoy and her guests for a discussion on Dena'ina history and culture in Anchorage. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the chief content officer for Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.